In this lesson, we will continue with the five Beatitudes that we did not get to in our lesson last week. Let me begin by reminding us that a much better understanding of the scriptures that have come down to us from our Judeo-Christian heritage can be had if we realize that there's a hidden message in those scriptures. That message is about transformation. You see, the Bible is not about salvation. I have some shocking news. You cannot find the system of salvation in the scriptures. But you can find a system of transformation. And to begin to understand that this is the message makes the scriptures come alive, and it makes our own lives begin to come alive. Think for a moment, if you will, about a species of caterpillars who have the potential of becoming butterflies, winged creatures of a higher order. But the species of caterpillars can only become butterflies by changing their thinking, by changing their attitudes. And they don't know that they have this hidden potential. They don't realize it. No other caterpillar ever told them, because caterpillars don't understand. And so these caterpillars, from time to time, are spoken to by one of their number who manages to break through and to be transformed, and then brings to them the message of transformation, telling them that if they would only follow him or her, they would follow the example. If they would do these certain things, then that their lives would change dramatically, that their whole level of being would change, that they would become a new order, a new kind, a new type of being with new thoughts, emotions, a new wisdom, a new understanding. That is exactly how it is with us. Some winged, blessed beings who have gone before us are speaking to awaken us. And the most blessed one of all, Jesus the Christ, said, among his other sayings, "Blessed are they which do hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled." Righteousness is another of the great key words of the Bible. It's one of those keys that the reader must have in his possession if he is to get the true meaning of the book. And words like earth and meek and comfort and righteousness are used in a special and definite sense that we don't fully understand or utilize in our normal language. Righteousness in the Bible means not merely right conduct, but right thinking on all subjects in every department of life. And if we study the Sermon on the Mount, we shall find in every clause that it reiterates the great truth that outside things are but the expression or the outpicturing of our inner thoughts and of our inner beliefs and attitudes. The Sermon on the Mount tells us over and over again that we have dominion or power over our thoughts to think as we will, and thus indirectly we mar our lives by the way in which we think and feel and respond to the circumstances around us. There was a time in my life when the word righteousness implied some form of goodness to me. I thought it meant those who pretended to be good, and I was most certain that I did not wish to be among them. I felt myself to be a being whose sensitivities were and needs were obviously much different from the righteous. And if I should ever choose to join such a state, it would be in some far distant time, but not in those moments. And I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. Jesus constantly, over and over, tells us that we have no direct power over outer things, because outer things are but the consequences, or if you like, the resultant pictures of what goes on in the secret place of our mind. Outer things are effects. And you can't change your life by working with effects. You have to begin to understand and work with the secret inner causes. If it were possible for us to affect externals directly without changing our thought, it would mean that we could think one thing and produce another. And this would be contrary to the law of the universe. The great law of the universe is that as you think and feel, so is your experience. And we have absolutely no power to change that law. We can only begin to understand it and work with it. It's this very notion that we can think and feel things in one way and have other experiences that lies at the root of all human trouble, all sickness, everywhere that we fall short, every failure that we have ever experienced or ever shall, all strife and poverty, even death itself is the result of us thinking that we can think and feel in one way and experience something that is different. It can never happen in this living universe. The great law of the universe is just this, that what you think in your mind, you will produce in your experience. As within, so without. And until a person begins to understand and accept this premise, this principle, it is impossible to understand any of the scriptures, but most particularly the things that are said in the New Testament, especially in the four Gospels. You must first control your thoughts for harmony and happiness, if you want harmony and happiness in your life, and then the outer things will follow. Your outer world will become the equivalent of the thoughts and feelings that are within. If you want health, you must first begin to think about health. And remember that thinking health does not mean merely thinking a healthy body, as important as that is, but it also means that you begin to think and feel in terms of peace and contentment and goodwill to all other persons. If you want to grow along spiritual lines, it's important to begin to explore the possibilities of our spiritual nature and begin to believe that we are spiritual beings living in a spiritual universe and holding those thoughts and working with this concept and doing all the things, reading the books and listening to the cassette tapes and working with our thought so that we give this movement of our spirit precedence. And it's what Jesus called seeking first the kingdom of God or of higher consciousness, knowing that as we do it, then everything else that we need in life shall be added to us. If you want material prosperity, you must first think prosperity thoughts and make a habit of doing that. It has to become the dominant thought and feeling pattern of one's life and requires a discipline that ordinary persons are just not prepared to undertake. The thing that keeps most people poor is the sheer habit of poverty thinking. They think and feel and act out the role of being poverty stricken. Perhaps you grew up in a family environment in which you were constantly reminded that there was just not enough. And don't leave anything on your plate. Don't you know that we can't even afford what we've put on your plate? Did you ever feel guilty about getting a new pair of shoes because you were reminded that the family did not have enough? Perhaps you did not experience that environment. But I will testify that some of us have, and we were impressed not only with the lack that was our lot, but also with a sense of unworthiness to receive what we had, much less even more than what we had. If you don't think that that kind of poverty consciousness requires some undoing, then look at your own life. Look at those moments in which you received some unexpected good and found yourself being depressed rather than rejoicing. How can something so wonderful happen to me and surely it will disappear before my very eyes? If you want congenial companionship, if you want to be loved, you must first become a loving person, sending out that which you would receive. Like begets like. And so it's necessary that whatever it is that we want, we must first become. We must be what we would have. And it's so easy when you get the hang of it because we already are all of these things. It's a matter of coming to believe it and to get the feeling for it. All things work together for the good of those who love good. And to love good means to occupy yourself with thoughts of good. When people awaken to a knowledge of these great truths, they naturally try to begin to apply them in their own lives, realizing at last the vital importance of righteousness, of keeping our thinking in line. Righteousness came to mean to me, I use this term, the right useness of my mind. Using my mind correctly and using my life correctly. No longer misusing this thought process. I came to believe that every thought I thought was important, and I found myself diligently working to be in charge of my thoughts. Came to be the most important thing in my life. And the principle involved is perfectly simple, but unfortunately, the doing of it is anything but easy. And why should this be? Why should it be so difficult for us to take charge of our thoughts and of our feelings? And the answer lies in the extraordinary power of habit. Do you know that we're creatures of habit? Watch yourself. You are so predictable to your neighbors and to the people around you, so am I. Because we are beings of habit. We form these habit patterns, and they become our comfort zones, and it's difficult to break out of them. Try going home a different way tonight and watch your car. It just will hardly do it. It seems to want to steer itself. We're creatures of habit. Now, if habits of our physical bodies are hard to break, and they are, then think how much more difficult it is for us to begin to take charge of our thinking and of our feelings. Our thoughts flow across the stage of consciousness in an unbroken stream. You're always thinking. You cannot not think. Have you noticed in times of meditation when you really tried to stop it that it just keeps going on and on, and there it is, and you want to break the thought, the pattern of it, and it you can't find the stopping place. Well, in your thoughts you can range over the whole area of your life, including all the people with whom you have been or am in any way concerned. You can soar away into the past or into the future with equal ease, and sometimes we do so almost in the same moment. We go back to the past, to something that is back there, and then we flit forward. But usually it's without taking thought. It is as though our mind is in control of its own self. We have not developed true righteousness, or the ability to rightly control our own thoughts. And for this reason, many people become discouraged with themselves and indulge in a great deal of self-condemnation when they come into the spiritual life. I can go back to the early days of my experience and recall that the first excitement that I experienced when I became aware that this is a spiritual universe and that I had this God-given ability and responsibility to change my world by changing my thinking. And I saw some amazing things take place as a result of just working with simple matters. And I was on top of the world. And in a little while, I began to discover how difficult it was to work with that second layer of negativity that was there, the anger and the resentments that were still living in me. And it became very discouraging. And then one day I became aware that it's impossible to fail if you and I continue to work on ourselves. If we are willing to make the effort on a daily basis to work against that negativity, then we cannot fail. Have you not had the experience of noticing someone that, or perhaps it was someone that you love very much, and they came into what we would call the spiritual life after you did, and you've been making some progress, but perhaps your progress had been slowed down and you weren't really turning out very many miracles during that period of time. And here comes this person in and they are no sooner in the door and all kinds of wonderful things start happening to them. And you look at them and it's not happening to you. Have you not had that experience? Discouraging, isn't it? Well, it really is exciting, but there is something in us that says, why not me? And the answer of why not me is because we have become somewhat discouraged. We've stopped working. And the good news is that usually the newer people who are involved continue to inspire us. I am the most blessed person on the earth because I get to watch all of you. And I can't quit because you're gaining on me. And you inspire me and you motivate me, and there's not a day in my life that I'm not reminded of the possibilities of miracles because I see you doing them. And sometimes you're doing them out of pure spiritual ignorance. You don't even have the hang of it yet. But I know something about you. In a little while you'll become discouraged too, and then we'll have our chance to shore you up and to let you know what the problem is. Now, if you've been moving along and with your spiritual growth and suddenly you're not making the progress that you wish to, the remedy is to take a searching and fearless mental inventory of yourself. Get honest with yourself as never before and see if you are not locked into some self-defeating thoughts or feelings. For example, are you still doing something that disturbs your peace of mind? It probably did not disturb your peace of mind before, but it is now. Check it out. Is there someone that you have not yet forgiven? And by George, you're not going to forgive them either. Are you indulging in any kind of political or racial, religious or corporate hatred or anger or contempt or blaming or judging or reacting? Have you taken up a cause over which you have no direct personal control, such as the environment or world hunger? You haven't got your own life straightened out yet, but you want to change conditions on another continent. You find yourself fiercely blaming those whom you judge to be the cause of the problem that you perceive to be there. And this is sure to be disguised under a cloak of self-righteousness. If it's there, see it for what it really is and get rid of it. Are there sentimental regrets clinging to the past, for example, yearnings for the impossible? Clear away the past. Or are you looking back to the good old days, the time that was? Well, prepare yourself to live this day. This is the one. and contained within it is all that we can handle. If we'd handle this one well, we have our hands full. Is there some kind of jealousy, personal or professional, eating at you? This is not as uncommon as you might think. So check it out and get rid of it. And this beatitude, Jesus tells us not to be discouraged because we're not going to overcome everything at once. If we're making any progress at all, if we are examining our lives, admitting our defects and our shortcomings, and praying for wisdom and guidance, and most particularly for the living action of the Holy Spirit upon us, we have no need to be discouraged. All we have to do is to keep on keeping on, and providing that our hearts are right and we are sincere. And if we're hungering and thirsting, if with all of our hearts we want to grow, we want to change, then you can be sure that the whole universe will respond. God is not mocked, nor will God mock His children. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. This is a brief summary of the law of life. And Jesus develops it more fully later on in the Sermon on the Mount. And most particularly, He points it out in the Lord's Prayer. Remember when in that part of the prayer that says, "Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us." One of the most important of all of the spiritual principles that each one of us needs to practice, and I can tell you that there are no miracles for the person who does not forgive and show mercy toward all other persons. There's not much need to dwell on this principle because it is so self-evident, and we'll be coming back to it again later on. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. This is one of those wonderful, wise, revealing sayings with which the Bible is so rich, and it's nothing less than a summing up in a few words of the whole philosophy of religion. As a matter of fact, the Scriptures use this word in the same far-ranging sense that it has used some of the other words that I've brought to your attention. But before we see what it means to be pure in heart, let's consider the promise that is in store for those who are pure in heart. It's nothing less than to see God. Now, Jesus either knew what He was talking about, or He did not know what He was talking about. And if He knew what He was talking about, He was giving us an assignment that, if understood and practiced, would produce the result, would give us the benefit or the reward that was indicated. Those that are pure in heart will see God. Now, we know that He's not talking about seeing God with our eyes or seeing God in the form of a person appearing, because God has no corporal form. So we're not talking about seeing with our physical vision other than being able to see the spirit, the life that's in each other person and in all other forms around us. We're talking about here to see in the sense of spiritual perception. And spiritual perception means just the capacity to become aware of, to apprehend the true nature of being, which we so sadly lack in our human condition. To see God means to become aware of the presence of God, to perceive with the mind. We live in God's world. It is said in other parts of the Bible that we live and move and have our being in God, and that God has God's being in us, meaning that your very life is an expression of the Spirit of God. But in our ordinary consciousness, we do not in the least perceive or know or see or apprehend life as it is. Heaven all around us lies, we've been told, and it is not a distant locality off in the sky, but because we're lacking in spiritual perception, we do not see it. And so the master teacher is saying, if when you become pure in heart, you will see some things, you will perceive some things, you will experience and understand some things that are denied you in the state of mind in which you normally reside, in which there is less than pureness in your heart. And therefore, as far as we're concerned, we may be said to be shut out of heaven. But if we're shut out, it's only because we have slammed the door of our own consciousness. Abraham Maslow, great psychologist who apparently himself had some deep insights as a result of his own spiritual transformation, wrote, and I quote, "The conception of heaven that emerges from the peak experiences is one which exists all the time around us, always available to step into for a little while at least." And Maslow indicated that heaven is always available. It is around us because it is in us. And he refers to something that he calls unity of consciousness, which would be the equivalent in our language of Christ or cosmic consciousness. It's the sense of oneness with all life and the sense of oneness with God. And he said that it's always a possibility for any serious and thoughtful person to step into this experience because it is to some measure under every person's control. And therefore, if we understand the system, then we can move into, for moments at least, this higher consciousness and see from it. And this is precisely what Jesus was talking about. In his book, The Sermon on the Mount, Emmett Fox used an example in which he said, "We are very much in the position of a colorblind man in a beautiful flower garden, and all around him are glorious colors, but he's quite unaware of them. He only sees the blacks and the whites and the grays. And if we suppose him to be also devoid of the sense of smell and of the sense of touch, we shall see that only a very small part of the glory of the garden exists for him. Yet it is there, if he could but sense it, if he could but see it." And so it is with us. There are persons who have had transcending or peak experiences. And in those moments, have seen, have felt, have known, have experienced the presence of God, and whose lives have been transformed. They are the butterflies who emerge from the cocoons of our dead humanity, our dead human consciousness. And to see God is to apprehend reality as it truly is, and to experience the infinite freedom and perfect bliss that is in those moments. Now, in this wonderful beatitude, we're told exactly how this supreme task is to be accomplished and who they are who shall do it. They're the pure in heart. And here again, we have to take the word pure not in the context of our normal language. And its complete sense, it means those who recognize God alone as the only real cause and the only real power in existence. This is the master key. When you and I reach that point in our consciousness that we stop believing in circumstances. Oh, the circumstances are there, but we don't make causes of them. We don't let them control us. When we believe that all things are working together for our good, when we have reached that place through working on ourselves, that we're in control of our moods and of our attitudes, of our thinking and of our feeling. When what we have come to intellectually understand is translated or transformed into our feeling nature, then we become pure in heart. Most people, and learned people especially, have all kinds of knowledge that does not in the least affect or improve their practical lives. Would you agree that a very large percentage of what you, and certainly what I know, is worthless, valueless? It's just a bunch of facts that we gathered along the way, and it has no value for us, and certainly no one else is interested in it. And if you think they are, pull out some of these things at a party and see how long it takes to disperse the crowd. It's head knowledge. It has to become heart knowledge. Real knowledge has to become heart knowledge. Knowledge of spiritual things, knowledge of our true nature and of our relationship with God becomes a living, feeling reality. And then in time it becomes accepted by the subconscious mind. Why do you think the Old Testament said, as a man thinketh in his heart, in his feeling nature? And the instruction, keep thy heart with all diligence, for out of it are the issues of life. Let reality become real. And you shall see God. Because you will have believed in God as the only reality. And God becomes that reality. And you will see God with the mind, will experience the glory, the joy of those transforming moments, the peak experiences. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. And in this wonderful beatitude, we receive an invaluable practical lesson in the art of prayer. And it's very important to remember that prayer is our only means of returning to our communion with God. And I use the word communion in the sense of its true meaning, that is, possession in common. I'm not talking about communion like the partaking of the elements, which is symbolic only. But the word communion means just exactly that, possession in common. You and I are individualized aspects of one mind, one spirit. The scriptures say there's one vine, but many branches. You're only one of the branches, and I'm another branch, but we all come out of the same mind. We're made out of the same stuff. Which one of us can possibly believe that we are superior to the other? That is the height of insanity, of not knowing. We're all the same. Our potential is the same. Our source is the same. Our God is the same. Same God. Whether we know it or believe it or accept it does not matter. And when we begin to feel that this communion, oneness, peace begins to come. Now, it's important to remember that prayer is the only thing that changes our character or our consciousness. We must realize that Jesus was teaching us a system of scientific prayer about the science and the art of changing our level of being from merely human to our spiritual condition. He was teaching us how to be born again, or how to be born from above, is really what he was saying to Nicodemus. How to be a different kind of being, how to be transformed. Now, prayer should be understood to be all of the activities that you undertake to bring about a changing of your mind. Prayer is not just those moments when you go down on your knees beside the bed, or the 15 or 20 minutes that you meditate in the morning. That is prayer, both. That process is prayer. Do you know that you're sitting in prayer right now? I'm the one that's doing most of the speaking. I'm sure that there's some conversation that you're hearing in your own head because we're always talking to each other. But you're in prayer because you came here so that you might be changed, so that your consciousness might be elevated. And this is an activity of prayer. If you understand prayer as anything and all of the things that you do that elevate your consciousness, when you're listening to good music, riding along in your automobile, you are in prayer. When you reach out to touch another person to help that person. This morning, a 19-year-old young man who works here at the church, who in recent times has been in deep trouble in his own life, but whose thinking has been changed and the transformation is taking place in him, had the opportunity to reach out and touch another person. using his experience and his insights to help another young man. And it made him feel so good, he could hardly stand it. He came into my office and he said, "Do you mind if I close the door?" And he sat down and told me how wonderful he felt. He's never felt better in his life than in a moment when he helped someone else be elevated in their own consciousness in a time of deep personal stress for them. That was prayer. Prayer is never the process of you or me trying to get God to change God's mind. How can the finite ever change the infinite? Prayer is not trying to get God to say yes when you thought God had said no. Prayer is changing your mind, raising it to the level where you are relating to or corresponding with, where you are in tune with the infinite. Prayer is tuning you and tuning into God. And the greatest essential ingredient for success in prayer, for obtaining that sense of the presence of God, is some degree of peace of mind, the true inner soul peace that was known to the mystics as serenity. And they try it over and over and over again to tell us that serenity is the passport to the presence of God. Jesus called serenity peace. The peace, as Paul said, that passes all understanding, all human awareness. And the peacemaker is spoken of in this beatitude are those who bring peace about in their own souls. It's those persons who have become willing to give up suffering, who are willing to give up their anger and their resentments, their anxieties, and their guilt. Those persons who are willing in the midst of the trauma and the fear of the moment to work with that almost superhuman effort that we have to make sometimes to rise up out of the meanness of our small self. They're the peacemakers. And it's important to know that the peace is already in us. It's not a matter of creating peace because you cannot. Serenity is the true state of your spiritual condition. It already exists. It's a matter of connecting with it. But we cannot take our misery into the secret place of the Most High. "Peace I leave with you, my peace I give unto you. Let not your heart be troubled, neither let it be afraid." Have you not been concerned about someone that you love who was ill, perhaps at the point of death, and you did not give yourself permission to feel at peace? Have you never had a moment of prayer in which suddenly peace came over you and you didn't even want to accept it? Because how could you feel peaceful when your beloved was so hurt? Well, be a peacemaker. Never, ever again, as long as you live, join another person in their misery. Miserable people love to rob us of our peace. Did you know that? Let's design to be one of the peacemakers and to put that peace in our own minds and hearts and to live from it. Some degree of serenity is essential to the attainment of any true concentration or any true development. And I will acknowledge that oftentimes we begin with anything but peace. But peace is the primary ingredient for success in prayer or for spiritual growth. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. They will experience the oneness with God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of God. Blessed are you when they revile and persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. Now, if everything that I've been saying to you is true, then this has got to be one of the most remarkable contradicting statements of all time. We've been talking about being at peace and the rewards that come and the joy that is ours. And here, this beatitude, we're told that blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. And the implication is that if you become a person who takes charge of your mind and works to demonstrate peace in your heart, then you will be persecuted. Then who are they who are coming to persecute us? Have any idea who they are? We are they. You for you and me for me. You see, this beatitude is not talking about you and me becoming peacemakers in the sense of looking around and finding other persons who are quarreling with each other and stepping in between them. That is a real good way to get bruised quickly. Have you ever tried to settle an argument between two other people? The first thing you know, they'll both be on your back if you aren't careful. Now, that doesn't mean that at times that we don't have this opportunity and responsibility to be a peaceful, determining factor in other person's lives. But we're talking here about the peace that comes within our own selves. He says that the peacemakers who do this, praying in meekness, shall obtain prosperity, inherit the earth, have their mourning turned into joy, and that in fact whatever they shall ask the Father in the manner of this teaching, that he will do. It's amazing, isn't it? Then that we're going to be persecuted for doing exactly that. And he points out that the prophets and the great illumined ones suffered these same things also. It's not an outside persecutor. It's that lower self of us that is always prepared to go into action when we have started to make some spiritual progress. You know, there's a principle physics that for every action there's an equal and opposing reaction. And the more progress that you make, the greater will be the tendency of the ego to resist that progress. And you will find that in those moments, in some great moments, you will be strongly tempted to hold the wrong thoughts about some situation or some person or about yourself. You've been going just great. Your life has changed dramatically. You're on top of it. And right in the middle of being on top of it, you find yourself depressed or angry. You've fallen back to the old way and you cannot understand how it is, and you're embarrassed and almost ashamed because it has happened to you. In that moment, you can know that you have been persecuted because of the progress that you've made, and that this is the greatest blessing that you have ever had. I look back upon my life, and I can tell you that some of my grandest days, my longest remembered days, were those difficult days when I was caught up in the fear or the terror of the moment or the anxiety of the future or the depression. The tendency that was trying to cause me to think, who are you to believe that such wonderful things could be your lot? And when I remembered, and I did, that all that I had to do was to resist that thought, to try with all my might and heart to keep on keeping on, that peace would come, that it would be the greatest blessing. It's always that way. We are blessed. All spiritual growth involves a tussle with our lower nature, which wishes to indulge in old self-defeating thinking and patterns. And so it reviles and persecutes us, to put it in the Oriental way of expression. But it's wonderful, because you'll know that you're making progress in the effort that you spend in those moments to make that a good day will transform your life. Those will be the days that you make the most progress. There are some people who may have a tendency to think that they're being persecuted because of their spirituality, because someone in their life has come to bang on their hood. Do you know what I'm talking about? That when you begin to grow spiritually, there will be those people who will come to resist you and to revile you. But they can only do so with your permission. So here again, if they're permitted to do so, it's because that we've made an inner choice that has resulted in an outer condition. Many years ago, I decided that if I was sick and tired of putting up with my own shortcomings, with my own unacceptable behavior, that I was absolutely not going to put up with anyone else's in my life ever again. So, if you think that the persecution that you're getting from another person is because you're very spiritual, I have some news for you. It's not. That's not what the Beatitude is about. It's because you're still putting up with something that no longer needs to be tolerated. Make the choice, the decision, that you are a spiritual being, living in a spiritual universe, and that this day is your day to grow along spiritual lines, and that the Lord God who formed the universe is at your fingertips and is guiding you. If you believe it, your world and your life and your mind and your heart, your affairs will be transformed. And that's the way it really is.